I know you're all very excited. We're going to have an exciting agenda, so let's go ahead and get started. We're going to start with Representative Hausman's House File 2031. Welcome to the Housing Committee, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I actually believe this may be the only bill other than my own that I'm presenting anywhere, so
right. It's
special an unusual welcome. Opportunity for me. And you're moving the bill, Madam Chair?
I'll move that House File 2031 be recommended to pass to the committee. Recommended. That it be sent to the committee, referred, I guess is the correct words now, to the Committee on Capital Investment.
And Madam Chair, I'm going to be very brief. You have a big agenda, and so I will just simply say that this is deals with both public housing and housing infrastructure bonds. And the relevant piece of history that I'll just talk about, public housing is the traditional general obligation bonding, but the last time around when I chaired this committee, the department came to me and said, we have the capacity to bond. And when the department does it, it doesn't have to be the publicly owned requirement for general obligation bonds. The reason this is an advantage is it means they can partner, among other things, with nonprofits, Lutheran Social Service, Catholic Charities, Common Bond, Beacon, many others. You'll hear from them today. And it leverages a lot of private money in addition to what we might do. And then we, on an ongoing basis, pay the debt service on those housing infrastructure bonds. And I have, you're going to be hearing the message from four testifiers. I'm only going to reference two things. In your packet, I provided two handouts. I hope they're there. One of them is University of Minnesota Research. And it's a very good read if you're looking for why we're motivated to move in this direction and to be so bold in our request for a significant amount of money. And just the one piece of this research that I will cite has to do with the achievement gap. As they track children who were homeless or highly mobile, they discovered that by the time these children have reached fifth grade, if they have been homeless or highly mobile, they achieve as a second grader who has been in stable housing. That's the achievement gap. That's the contribution that homelessness or the lack of stability in housing makes. All those billions we spend on education are better spent if we can provide that safe place to live. The other one is an article from the Seattle Times in which they discuss their own local situation, and they reference the state of Utah. And at the bottom of that page, you see a surprising success in the state of Utah, that Utah's State Homeless Coordinating Committee cut homelessness by 78% over the past 8 years. The goal is to end homelessness by 2015. And whereas the organization that the author is referencing is a coalition that tries to sort people into the right kind of housing because everybody has different requirements, they say Utah cuts to the chase. It moves chronically homeless people off the street into permanent supportive housing, and the only requirement is that the people behave themselves. Utah provides the free housing not because of bleeding hearts, but for practical reasons. It costs less to provide housing than it does to pay all the community costs that come with having people living on the streets. And there was a letter to the editor in the Star Tribune sometime in this cold, cold winter from a woman who found in the back alley behind her house a couple who were there, and they had damaged fingers from the cold. And she did what, you know, the frostbite was evident. And she did what any compassionate person would do. She called the ambulance, and of course that ambulance will take them off to an emergency room and they will be treated. And that's one of the costs that Utah realized. Because this couple didn't have a warm place to be, we will have a significant health care cost. And that's only an example of, and we could give many more. And so, Madam Chair, because you have limited time, I won't say much more than that. There are some testifiers that will fill in the blanks, and I believe Danielle, the Homes for All Coalition is the first one up, and then she'll get us started.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Dannon.
Hello, my name is Dariel Dannon, and I am one of the co-chairs of Homes for All. I might look a little familiar. I think we were in front of this committee quite a few times last session. I'm just teeing things up for our testifiers today. I did want to let you know that, or remind you that Homes for All is the large conglomeration of folks who are really supporting solutions that will help end some of the housing issues in our communities. That group, I think last year when I was here in front of this committee, we had about 80 supporters of that effort. We're over 100 now, and are joined by folks like Education Minnesota, I think for the same reasons that the representative was talking about making sure we close the achievement gap. We're joined by AFL-CIO. We're joined by groups like the Architects International Association. So many, many groups that not just, I think, the people we would assume would be supportive, so housing organizations, but many others as well. And we're bringing this bill forward because we in the state of Minnesota are in need of housing options for our most vulnerable population. So low-income seniors, people with disabilities, homeless youth, and families. But we risk losing our most important safety net housing, so the federally assisted public housing and project-based Section 8. If that's not preserved, that housing and those federal dollars that are attached to it will go away, and they will never return to our state again. And supporting this ask, we will be able to build and rehab housing, which will create jobs. And when we looked at sort of the housing that's a little bit shovel-ready or could be funded right away, we've got over 6,000 units. So we actually had over $1 billion worth of housing that could theoretically be built throughout the state if we had dollars on the table ready to support it. Mm-hmm. And with that, I think we'll have a few folks come talk about some of these separate needs. The first one is talking about public housing. And I'll provide a handout to the committee about that sort of outlines, and it has maps on the backside that kind of show where these housing options are throughout the state, and kind of talks about really what these dollars would do on the front side. Go
ahead. Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Fellow committee members, my name is Randall Hammerlin. I am the executive director of the Red Wing Housing and Redevelopment Authority, but I'm also the president of Minnesota NARL, which is the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. In Minnesota, NARL represents 120 public housing and HRAs, or Housing Redevelopment Authorities, across the state of Minnesota. So what I'm speaking to you today is not just from my Red Wing perspective, but also from the statewide perspective itself. We represent authorities that are as large as St. Paul Public Housing Authority with over 4,000 units, and then also authorities that may only have 35 units in some of the more rural areas. So we are Minnesota NARL is the voice for PHAs and HRAs across the state. With that, I want to say thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. What we're asking you to consider today in the upcoming bonding bill is very important to the health of our residents, our community, and our state. And public housing in Minnesota is about 21,000 units strong. And I have conservatively placed the number of its value to us in terms of replacement at about $3.5 billion. Some would argue that that's too low. But that's just, I think a conservative estimate. And many of these public housing units were built in the 1960s and the 1970s. And they're now at that stage where just normal maintenance means capital replacement. And by that, I mean things such as windows, doors, roofs, parking lots, sprinkler systems, and mechanicals. They just need to be replaced due to their age. And sometimes we need to do upgrades, such as in our elevators for fire code upgrades or handicap accessibility, as the standards have changed over the last 40 years. That's why I'm here to you today to ask for support for the $20 million in the bonding bill to be used for public housing, and I also support the full $100 million for affordable housing. Now, last year was a very difficult year for public housing authorities and HRAs across the state of Minnesota. As you probably will remember, at the congressional level in Washington, D.C., there was a lot of budget fighting going on, and you all remember the word sequestration. We out there in the country had no trouble remembering these things because they affected us directly. And we saw that our budgets were not what they used to be. So that we're starting to see some strains on doing some of the capital improvements that we need to do. And what I'd like to do also is just explain to you a little bit about my situation in Red Wing, because I can bring it home very quickly to you, I think, and show you what it means. We have 119 units of public housing in Red Wing, and my replacement value is about $20 million. Right now, I receive about $65,000 a year from the federal government in order to maintain these units. Now, I've had appraisal training well over 300 hours in my career, and what I want to say is that one of the thumb rules we use is if you want a building to last 100 years, it's 1% depreciation. You just take 100% divided by 100 years, you get 1%. If you want it to last 50 years, it's 2% depreciation per year. And if we were to say that I have $20 million worth of real estate and I want to depreciate it over 100 years, I should be replacing 1% of the value every year. That's $200,000. And yet I'm receiving $65,000 to do that. So we have a gap there, as you can just do in your own minds. Now, the PHAs, public housing authorities, and the housing redevelopment authorities across the state are in this soup together with me. I'm not the only one that's experiencing that. And what I want to say on that is that I'm really a strong believer in the broken window theory, because once the window is broken and it's not replaced, or once the elevator doesn't work the way it's supposed to, or once the door doesn't work the way it's supposed to, not only does the residents stop respecting the building, but so does the community. And that leads into vacancies and all kinds of things. It becomes a blighted property. That is not good for Minnesota. Now, what I have said earlier, we have 21,000 housing units across the state of Minnesota. So you can see that this is a good situation that we have to deal with. PHAs and HRAs serve the elderly. We serve the disabled. We serve the local workforce. We serve the homeless. And what we're talking about here is our most vulnerable population is at risk of losing housing units. We ask for the state's assistance in this bonding bill to avoid this situation. Now, I want to mention to you a little bit how it worked the last time I received some of this bonding funds. Bonding money is used with other funds that we come to the table with, and so we're using it as leverage to help us do the projects we want to do. The Red Wing HRA was fortunate in the last round that we received $405,000 in bonding funds. We matched those funds with over 20% of funds from our federal sources and also local resources. And we were able to modernize two elevators in a 9-story building, plus upgrade two public restrooms and a tub room to full handicap accessibility. Without these funds, we still would have had to upgrade the elevators because it was they were due to fire codes that needed to be upgraded. Without the bonding funds, we went from a high-performing HRA to a troubled HRA based on financial issues. And that's how HUD judges you on how much financial stability you have in a project. And they are always requiring us to have 4 to 6 months of reserves. If we did not receive that $405,000, we would have dropped it down to near zero, and we would have been a troubled HRA at that point in time. Right now, we're not. We're still a high performer because we received these funds. I also want to mention to you that with these funds, we were able to contract with a Minnesota-based architect firm, that's St. Paul's Finn Daniels. Our elevator consultant was VDA from Minneapolis office. We used Schumacher Elevator Company of St. Paul to do the upgrades, and we did a locally owned Redmond Construction Company did our rehab work. So these monies are not just spent and the money goes out, they come back into the economy. And they do, and they give jobs, and they give all kinds of other supports in that regard. So, in summary, Minnesota NARL supports the request for $100 million in the bonding bill to be used for affordable housing. We also respectfully ask that $20 million of it be used for PHAs and HRAs for rehabilitation of public housing units. I hope that my talk today showed that it helps the local PHA and HRA stay financially solvent, does the necessary rehab work, employs local and state business firms and workers, and most importantly, maintains housing for elderly, the disabled, the local workforce, and homeless populations. And I want to say thank you again for allowing me to speak to you today on behalf of Minnesota NARL and the communities we represent across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Himmelin. I think because of the time, we'll go through each of the witnesses, and then if there's questions from committee members, is that okay, everybody? Okay. Thank you very much. Next is George Stone. Julian, you called me. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Stone, and I am the Minnesota Director for CSH. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of House File 2031. CSH is a national nonprofit that uses solutions, housing solutions, to improve the lives of the most vulnerable people in communities across the country. And we have supported the creation of supportive housing here in Minnesota since 1993. We deliver expertise, ideas, information, and capital for housing solutions that use housing as a platform for services. Supportive housing has proven to work for people struggling with complex and serious challenges like homelessness. And it's also a more effective use of limited public resources. As you are aware, House File 2031 seeks $100 million for statewide investment in affordable housing, $80 million for housing infrastructure bonds, and $20 million for general obligation bonds. Among the uses for this investment are affordable housing preservation, foreclosure recovery, and the creation and rehabilitation of supportive housing. The governor has included $50 million in his 2014 capital budget to address statewide housing needs, and for a variety of reasons, now is an opportune time to double our efforts. Among the most important reasons is timing. In 2013, the state reconstituted Minnesota's Interagency Council on Homelessness, engaging state leaders, including the governor, in developing Heading Home Minnesota's plan to prevent and end homelessness, otherwise known as the state plan, and appointing a state director to prevent and end homelessness to guide the development and the implementation of this plan. Supportive housing is one of the key platforms for achieving the objectives of the state plan. Increased investment at this time will amplify our impact and accelerate the pace at which our partners are able to prevent and end homelessness. Another compelling reason is that every day a person experiences homelessness in Minnesota, it is a waste of both scarce public resources and sadly human potential. I'm talking about people like an ex-Marine named Joseph, who spent the majority of his adult life either behind bars or on the street. Living that way, he accumulated a host of health problems, including pneumonia, arthritis, alcoholism, anxiety disorder, and PTSD. Joseph treated these with regular visits to the emergency room. In the last 10 years, I've had pneumonia 5 times, he says. I was hospitalized for all of them. Homeless consistently since 2010, in February 2012, he enrolled in a hospital-to-home supportive housing program in Ramsey County. Soon, he moved into a new apartment and started seeing a primary care physician, and he was managing his health, including his schizophrenia. I haven't been to the emergency room in over a year, he says. They're actually calling me and asking me how I was doing. Joseph likes to watch movies, listen to music, create artwork in his new apartment. Compared to this time last year, I'm doing 600 times better, he says. Today, because of his opportunity in supportive housing, Joseph has maintained stable housing for over a year. He visits a primary care clinic for health care needs rather than the regular use of the emergency department. He has not been arrested in 3 years. He's taking steps towards sobriety, looking forward to reconnecting with his friends and family, and is setting goals to enhance his skills through training and seeking employment. As leaders representing our entire state, you might be concerned that programs like this are imbalanced in terms of geographic reach. Let me assure you this is not the case. Neither the problem nor, thankfully, the solutions are resigned to the metro area. There are people experiencing homelessness and supportive housing working to house them all across our state. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today in favor of House File 2031. We know that housing remains out of reach for far too many Minnesotans, especially children and youth. We also know what works to fix this problem, but we must make the necessary investments to implement the solutions that will demonstrate a return on that investment. We recognize the importance of housing stability to improving educational outcomes for our children, building a strong workforce, supporting good health outcomes, and reducing disparities among our populations. I encourage you to act on the opportunity in front of the legislature this year and to show the courage it will take to help lead our state into a new era of potential and prosperity for all Minnesotans. Thank you very much, and I'll wait for any questions you may
thank
have.
You, thank you very much, Mr. Stone. Next, Carolyn Horton, and then I believe the last person on the list is Julian Lascauzel. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Horton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Caroline Horton. I work with Aon. We are a nonprofit developer, owner, and manager of affordable housing here in the Twin Cities metro area. We own approximately 38 properties and serve about 4,000 people in any given year. We've really been a long-term partner with the state and the city and the counties that we work in sort of solving the homelessness problem to the extent that it can be solved, and certainly addressing it. We use federal funds in many of our properties, and I'd like to tell you about one as an example of a property that is supportive housing and that could be aided with this type of bonding funding. Opportunity Housing Partnership is located in Minneapolis. It's in downtown Minneapolis, provides 130 apartment homes for people who've been formerly homeless across three buildings. The purchase and renovation of these buildings 22 years ago was in response to the 1991 City-County Task Force on Homelessness and helped address the issues raised at that time through that effort. So they've been around now for 22 years. Recently, we've also worked with the state's initiative on ending long-term homelessness, and so we currently have 97 residents of those properties who have been long-term homeless. Most of our residents have some sort of disability, many physical disabilities, mental health disabilities, chemical dependency. Most would not be accepted by conventional landlords in conventional housing, not only because they don't have adequate money to pay the rent, but because they have something in their past history that would not allow them to meet the selection criteria of those landlords. So our folks at Opportunity Housing not only need housing, but they need some wraparound services to help them stabilize their lives and get on their feet and move on to the next thing. So we have staff there during the day, case management, other service providing staff who help connect them to employment resources, educational resources, food assistance, mental health, physical health, chemical health, any type of resources that people need to become stable and then retain that housing, we help provide. Two of those properties also have a 24-hour front desk so that if there is an emergency in the middle of the night, there is someone there to help them with that. The impacts of Opportunity Housing Program are numerous. Like I mentioned, we provide homes for 130 formerly homeless folks. These are high-demand rentals. We have very little vacancy, and we have people waiting to get in. We give people an opportunity that some folks have never had, a basic opportunity to make a home for themselves. And in 22 years of operations, Opportunity Housing, which is right downtown Minneapolis, close to many businesses, high-end condominiums, just kitty-corner across the street, has been an excellent neighbor to those other entities and to the folks who live in the condos. Last but not least, Opportunity Housing is a very cost-effective way to provide for our homeless population. We've basically saved the city and the county thousands of dollars in emergency health care services, in shelter services, in police and public safety dollars. And in terms of preservation, for every $1 that the state would spend to preserve this type of housing, it leverages three additional dollars in federal funding. So the preservation would not only retain the federal subsidies that already exist, but would actually leverage more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Lascalzo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julian Lascalzo, pinch hitting today for Jeff Washburn, the Minnesota Coalition for Community Land Trust. And since it is spring training, they would never let a singles guy like me back cleanup, but we'll see what we can do today and put this in play. The Community Land Trust operate in about 50 cities across the state of Minnesota, and they work in conjunction with local units of government to provide ownership opportunities for working families. Currently, there's over 1,000 units of housing throughout the state with working families with an average income of $36,000 a year who have been able to purchase usually their first home. The bond allocations are a critical component to the program that operates for the community land trust, and that allows the local community land trust to purchase and acquire the land underneath the house, and that is the mechanism by which you can keep those properties affordable, into the future, 20, 30, 40 years. The acquisition of that land allows them to kind of leverage additional dollars to make those homes available, as I said, to folks who maybe make $36,000 a year on a whole. During the last round of bond proceeds, I think six or seven of the organizations received funding through the Minnesota Housing MHFA, Minnesota, it is Minnesota Housing, MHFA, which funded approximately 50 units of housing, of which I think 40 have been acquired and are now currently occupied. So again, the land trust bring to this component, sort of the ownership component, the opportunity for folks to primarily buy their first home in the which they will then proceed to kind of move on to market rate housing. The other last note should be is that I know we had some discussions about some of the housing disparities. Over 30% of the homes that are owned by people of color, and they operate within the inner cities, the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, the communities that, believe it or not, they have large housing trusts that operate in the western and eastern suburbs, along with Rochester, Duluth, and I think in greater Minnesota through Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. So with that, I'm glad to stand for questions, but this the bond proceeds have been very a very important critical component to allow these folks to acquire their first homes.
Thank you. Committee members, if you have questions now for any of the witnesses or Representative Hausman, I think there was Representative Radinovich had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who best to answer this question, but last year in this committee, we heard some very compelling testimony about homelessness statewide. And I think that in the lobbying effort to pass some of the legislation that offered housing for those who are homeless across the state, those of us in greater Minnesota heard stories about how we may not understand that homelessness affects our community. It may not be as present as it is in other parts of the state, but certainly it does. And there was a young man named Derek who had come down from Lutheran Social Services in Brainerd and shared his story. And what was striking was that people in greater Minnesota were staying in fish houses, on friends' couches, and in situations even much worse than that. So I guess, when we're looking at this bonding money, the question I have is, we understand, based on the Utah model, how valuable these types of services are and how much better alternative they are than the options that exist today. So could you explain to me, how much of this we would maybe see going into greater Minnesota? Would it be based on need? Would it be, what type of projection would you have there?
Mrs. Dannon.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's a great question. And as we were putting together our group of folks, we didn't have a lot of time, but one of the things we were thinking about is making sure to impart to this committee how these resources really are deployed and utilized throughout the state. And if you do look at the handout that I handed out, the backside has some maps on it to really show that. I was a little bit surprised. I always have to refresh my memory, but that there are either both public housing and Section 8 housing options in every county in our state. So if this committee remembers from last year, how these resources would be deployed is they'd be deployed through a competitive request for proposals process. So Minnesota Housing has always been a great partner and would ask for proposals, receive those, and then rank them based on leveraging and competitiveness and community support, and then would deploy those resources. But they're very deliberate about making sure that greater Minnesota is well represented. In fact, the resources that this committee helped to allocate last session, I noticed that there were slightly more units that were built in greater Minnesota with those resources than in the metro area.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Not Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair, I'm assuming everyone were these in everybody's packet,
yes,
so that they did get the map. And I will just simply conclude. I think I'm giving the correct information. It's like half of all of those who are homeless on any night are under 20. Something like that.
Yes.
It's these are families, these are children in school. But today, in closing, I just want to give a tribute to the housing advocacy groups that have all visited you. I suspect there has been huge effort since last year. You may recall we had $50 million in the bill that did not pass. We had intended another $50 million this year, so we are going. We're staying on track to do $100 million, and they're spreading the word and they're telling the story. They're joined by countless faith communities across the state. I don't think I've ever been asked to speak to more groups on a subject than this. So there's huge effort among citizens in Minnesota who understand this and who understand this as a wise investment. So on behalf of all of those people working very hard on this, I present this bill to you. And as you know, it goes on to the Capital Investment Committee where there are quite a number of priorities, but we know this is right at the top.
Thank you. I think there was a question from Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe you kind of answered this, but I was just kind of curious as to why when the governor rolled out his plan, it was half of what this is. And I know you kind of alluded to that, but I'm guessing there should be a little more coordination, I guess, between the governor's, you know, and office and this bill. Maybe you could explain what the disconnect is and why there's not that communication back and forth, why it's not the same number.
Well, being another author who's trying to put the bill together, I can tell you we hear a lot of pressure around this legislature to keep the bill small, but as one who is already putting all of the needs onto a spreadsheet, I know that is very hard, and so I know exactly what the governor was facing when he began to put all of the issues from higher education to wastewater infrastructure to transportation to public safety and corrections. The needs are great, and I think he was trying very hard to stay under that, what is that psychological barrier we have of $1 billion, and I suspect that's why he settled on that number.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if he's putting all these pieces together and he's trying to stay under $1 billion, then what would this do? Would this push it back up over $1 billion? And
well, the conversation we'll begin to have now about infrastructure is there's some conversation about, because this is one-time spending, this is infrastructure that's sort of particularly in the area of higher education where there's a huge backlog. I think when I looked at the Minsky list, most of those, the majority of them, have been brought to us in 2008, 2010, 2012. There was 1 year when the bill was vetoed in totality, and then we didn't get to it at all. There was another year where there were significant line item vetoes, and so the backlog in a number of these areas, like higher education, and I'm thinking Oliver Kelly Farm that we've tried for years and years. I see a few people around the table who know the reality of some of these. But I think as we look at the opportunities this year, probably one of the things that I know I will raise is this a good time to use at least a small amount of that cash to do a little more infrastructure?
Thank you. Just one final comment, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the latitude. I guess as we're putting all these pieces together, I would just caution that if this is double what the governor had even proposed and he was already close to that $1 billion, I would just caution that we would likewise look at the total picture. And I always talk about not looking at things in a silo. I understand the pressure. I understand the needs. But there certainly are, as you just articulated so well, needs across the entire state and all the different areas. So I would just caution us as a committee moving forward that we need to look at the big picture, the totality of that budget moving forward.
And I can tell you, members, that at least in one area, as I'm looking at this, where I would perhaps be a little less aggressive, the governor puts $126 million of his bill into the capital. I will probably do less than that because we actually aren't going to be spending that. I always hate to tie up a lot of bonding authority for something that we aren't going to spend for a couple of years. And so given the serious nature of this and the cost to be saved if we do this right, for us to pay for the capital when it's something like $267 million, I think, to pay for it over 3 years instead of two strikes me as maybe a good thing to do.
Representative Anderson, final question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It'll be quick. Representative Hausman, the bill expands the use of some of this bonding proceeds for something we have here called foreclosure priority areas. What exactly are those areas?
Now, is that where we have a little bit of a question about the language yet? And so I would just invite, they're the experts. And there's one area of the bill where I think they're still working through the language that we might change. And I don't want to rush in if this is where it is. I'm presenting this bill on their behalf, and they are the experts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Anderson, the agency has identified a number of zip codes, for lack of a better term, that have a high concentration of foreclosed properties. And the question that they have identified those properties, those zip codes in terms of places would like the funds targeted. The community land trusts are in discussions with them regarding focusing in those areas or even on abandoned and foreclosed properties, because the marketplace has changed to some degree in terms of those properties now becoming very competitive in terms of pricing. So what the agency attempted to do was to identify areas where they would like us to focus some of the activities of the land trust, and we're having some discussions with them about, you know, whether how well that will work for some of us. I hope that answers your question.
And if you have any either opinion or suggestion, talk to me or others, but I think all of the players here are going to continue to have conversation about that, so we get the language right.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. The House File 2031 is before us to be referred to capital investment. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Sounds unanimous. Thank you. I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Bly.
Do you have a motion you'd like to make for us, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2116. This is going to be for discussion today because we do not have our targets, but we're going to have the discussion today, our witnesses, and then when we get our targets, we'll be able to vote on actually whether or not we have the money to spend on it.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman and members, I bring you this bill. It was brought to me by constituents from actually around the area, not just in my own district, who are having a lot of problems with being able to retain their rental housing because they have a child with a severe disability that is causing some damage to the property. Lots of mobility happening because of that, and I think we just heard in the last discussion what happens when families with children are moved around, what happens to the children in terms of their abilities to achieve and so on. So, Mr. Chair, the bill before you will assist with that, and I'm going to ask the witnesses to come forward. We'll talk about, hear their stories first, and then we'll go more specifically to what the bill says, if that's okay with members. So the first person I want to call is Mariam, I believe. Mariam, are you coming, or are you asking the other witnesses to come? I'm not sure who's name. Okay. Come on down.
Welcome. Would you please introduce yourself for the record? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir, and chairman, and the members of the Housing Committee. My name is Deka Hussein. I'm the mother of six children. I have my five-year-old son has autism. I'm representing the Somali communities and the Somali mothers who are struggling with their children. We've had a huge problem renting because if you look at the studies done by University of Minnesota, there's a high prevalence of Somali children with autism, and within the Somali community now, 1 in 32 children have autism, and mothers are really struggling to actually understand what autism is. It's a really new diagnosis for our community. We didn't have that back in Somalia. So even to get the diagnosis within our community is very hard. The child doesn't get diagnosed by the time until it's too late, and they're in first grade or pre-K when they start having problems in the classroom and aggression and everything. And mothers are struggling to find ways to accommodate their children, and many of these properties are not equipped or it's not reasonably accommodated. And when children destroy the homes, autism, I don't know if everyone is aware of it, is a developmental delay in social norms, and kids don't know they're destroying or they're destructive. They break a lot of appliances, and lack of cultural barrier and lack of the language is allowing these families to be evicted from the housings. They are being, the neighbors are also even complaining about how loud their family, the children are, and some landlords are not even coming to actually fix the appliances or fix the property because it's been damaged several times. So on behalf of the Somali communities, I'm asking the members to consider the difficulties as the mothers were going through and to pass this bill to help us at least find a place where we can raise our children without being feared to be evicted from the house.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next, I'd like to call, I believe, Abdirizak Jama? Or Mukta Jama? I've got three names here, and I'm not sure who's coming. Come on now.
Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Okay. Dear Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Dirsaq Chama. I have 11 years old, boy named Ayub with severe autism, compounded with a seizure. In addition to Ayub, I have four other children, three boys and one girl, ages 14, 13, 8 and 5. We live on the second floor in a small four-bedroom apartment in South Minneapolis. Due to the severity of the condition, my son has self-regulation issues, and therefore we are constantly on the lookout to ensure his safety. What exasperated the situation is that he did not get any therapeutic service up until this past September. He is still on the diaper and constantly undresses himself and causes self-injury and damage to everything around him. My son Ayub's condition has caused our family a lot of hardship, affecting both our health and quality of life. He is a self-destructive, has sleep issues, damages the property, and run out of the apartment into the streets. There were numerous occasions that he ran away, and we had to call to the police for help. I had a stroke, and my wife contracted hypertension. Our sleep is disrupted because he wakes up in the middle of the night, screaming and banging on the walls. This has affected our other children, and they are having issues at school. The teachers call and complain that they doze off in the class and are not up to the speed academically. Also, there was a time that another teacher told us that my three other boys are obese and need to participate in sport. This affects also our neighbors. As a result, since 2008, we have been affected three times. Also, this has caused us both emotional and financial drain. Even this landlord I am living in current sent us an eviction notice. I went to him and told him about our condition and begged him to give me a chance and to leave until we got a place for our own. He is very kind, and we are temporarily staying in this apartment with no lease. In some, my son's situation has caused our family a lot of hardship, and we are in fear of eviction any day. We don't have a good rental history, and therefore at risk of becoming homeless. With all that said, we beg you to give us a chance to have our own homes with enough space to manage a child with autism and safety proof, so we don't have to fear landlord summons, defection, disturbing the neighbors, and have a chance of living normal, sustainable life, so we can be a productive citizens in our society. Thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two more witnesses, Mukhtar Jama and Eric Chanel. Maybe they could both come down so we can go forward quickly. I know we're short on time, so.
All right.
Excuse me, this is
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Dear Madam Chair, member of committee.
Just speak right into the microphone.
Can you move a little closer to the microphone?
Speak right into it like this.
Okay. Dear Madam Chair, member of committee, my name is Mukhtar Jama. I live with my three children and my wife, two boys and one girl, in a three-bedroom apartment in South Minneapolis. Two of my sons, Hassan and Ali, who are 6 years and 4 years, have severe autism. Because of the severity of their autism, both of my sons are still wearing diapers with extra tape, and we have to have their clothes put on backward to prevent them from putting their hands inside their daddy diapers. They also have serious self-regulation issues. When Ali has been diagnosed with autism, it was very difficult diagnosis for us because we are already dealing with Hassan's diagnosis. Having two children on the spectrum is very difficult. Each day is very overwhelming, stressful. Both of my sons require around-the-clock care, or else they will run. And when they run, they don't look backward. They don't look back and are not capable of looking sideways, either to see if vehicle is approaching. Thus, we are very concerned for their safety. It's very difficult to keep both of them quiet. They bang on the walls and make holes. They cause a lot of property damage. We often get many complaints from our neighbors to the property manager. So we have been threatened with a repeated eviction notice. We are always in constant fear of being evicted and becoming homeless. So each time that my sons break appliances or drill holes in the apartments, we repair it with our own expenses, fearing that if we inform the managers of the property, we may face to buy extra or worse, face an eviction. Even though we haven't been affected yet, it's a huge concern that we battle with every day. We really need a single family house where my sons can be allowed to be themselves. This problem is not a problem or an issue that only for my family faces, but it constant battle for many other families with autism children. So it's our earnest hope that you will consider helping and let this bill move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Representative Isaacson, in whose district I live, in Southern Shoreview. My name is Eric Schnell, and I am a father of a 17-year-old boy, Tim, who has autism. I need to start with a couple things. One is that I have such respect for the members of the Somali community who are here today, who are living with autism and the ravages that that can bring on a home. The second thing is, if tears can be testimony, you're going to get a little bit of testimony today, and I apologize in advance, but it's hard not to be a parent and not have tears. I'm here because my family was caught, much like my brothers and sisters in the Somali community, in a perfect storm of sorts. We knew something was wrong the minute Tim was born. He had a hard time waking up, and then he had a hard time sleeping. He didn't sleep through the night for the first 5 years of his life. My wife and I quickly learned that there's a reason why. There's a reason why sleep deprivation is used as a form of torture. My son would startle in our rental apartment when an icicle dropped, and it would wake him up and he would start bawling. My son would choke on food because he didn't have oral motor coordination skills. My son would cry throughout the night. My wife and I started crying. We cried when we tried to get him into therapy, and we couldn't because the wait lists were too long in the Twin Cities. So we had to drive him to Wisconsin 3 days a week while somehow maintaining a job. We cried on his first birthday when we had a party for him, and he cried when people sang, and he cried when the cake was put on his table, and he cried when the police came, because they heard all the crying, and they wondered if we were abusing our one-year-old. That's quite a first birthday. A neighbor had called, a neighbor in our apartment, wondering what on earth was happening down below. We were trying to raise an autistic son. Just before Tim turned three, we were lucky enough to purchase a home and moved into that home. And the problems continued. I took my son, one day when he was about four, I took my son to the Children's Museum. He loved going to the Children's Museum. It was hard for me because you get the looks. You get the looks of the people who are wondering why your child's behaving that way. He loved being there, though. And I guess that's one of the gifts of autism, is that you're not quite as clued in to the social skills or the social cues that other people present. I brought him home that night. He had a hard time leaving the Children's Museum. He was crying. And he was screaming still when I got home. And he started beating me. My four-year-old started hitting me. Now, it's a four-year-old hitting you. It didn't bruise me or anything. But it hurt me in other ways that I started crying. And I went out on my front doorstep. Mr. Chair, members, the only thing that would have made that harder is if I didn't have a doorstep to sit on. The only thing that would have made that experience harder is if I hadn't been in that single family house, and if I had had neighbors who were calling to complain, just like the people who testified earlier said, if I'd had a landlord who threatened to evict me because of my child's disability. That's the only thing that could have made that life harder for me at that point. So let me fast forward, if I may, to last night, where I took my 17-year-old son out for an apple cider at a local coffee shop. And I had a conversation with my 17-year-old son, a conversation I wonder if I would have been able to have if I hadn't had that space to raise him. And in that conversation, I told him what I intended to do today, that I intended to speak with you, that I intended to ask you to support this critical bill that will provide the opportunity for folks who are struggling with autism to help themselves be contributing members of the community. And he said he approved. I told him that I was going to tell the story of the Children's Museum, and he didn't know the story, so I relayed the story to him, and he sat back and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Well, Dad, that must have sucked." I'm happy. He also said, though, that I must tell you what he's doing today and how well he's doing. He's 17 years old. He's a junior at Mountview High School. He gives a quarter of his allowance to charities, including homeless shelters and food shelves. He's becoming quite the philanthropist, and if I may caution you, he's becoming quite interested in politics as well. I am so proud of the man he is. Mr. Chair, members, I hope you'll support this critical bill and give other families the opportunity to raise their autistic children in a safe environment. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, members, I have one last person to testify, Kristen Beckman. And we are presenting this testimony not only to talk about the problems, but we've come up with some solutions that are in this bill. And it's a pilot program, and Speckman will talk with you about how the organization that she works with may be able to be a recipient of some dollars that are in this bill to help provide home ownership. So,
thank you. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, my name is Kristen Beckman, and I'm the Vice President of Programs and Services at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. And Abu, do I just hit enter on this to make us go? So Twin Cities Habitat has been wrestling with this issue of how to provide housing for families with accessibility issues for the 27 years that we've been in operation. And one of the ways that we've figured out how to do that is that we budget for every year that we're going to build two houses in the Twin Cities metro area, because we're the affiliate that's just got the seven counties. There are 30 other affiliates in the state. We budget two houses a year that we're going to make accessible. We're going to be custom home builders for families with disabilities. And one of the reasons we have to budget for that specially, and one of those reasons there's only two out of the 55 to 60 we build a year, is that to build to accessibility needs for a family costs more money than we typically would develop. And so there's always a gap when you're building a house, and you try to minimize that gap as much as possible. But, you know, not only do I show you a map of the 52 homeowners that we've sold houses to in the Phillips neighborhood, to blatantly ingratiate myself to the committee author, or the bill's author, but also because in this neighborhood at 2447 14th Avenue South, is this adorable little house. And this house we built last year to meet the needs, the accessibility needs of the family who lives there. So this is the dad. We have a dedication when we close on a house. All the volunteers who have worked on it and the family comes together and, you know, we say a prayer, or we have a cheesecake. And so this is the dad saying thank you to the family members. And if you can see in the picture, he's a double amputee. So his job is as an interpreter, and he's got a good income as an interpreter, and he is able to pay the Habitat mortgage. This is the other thing about Habitat. I think everybody knows volunteers build our houses, but what not everybody knows is that we are the mortgage originator. So it's our note. It's a 30-year mortgage, a 0% interest. It's the best deal in town. You cannot make more than 60% area median income, though, and that's about $40,000 a year for a family of four. So this father has, it's a family of eight that moved into this house. In addition to his having a double amputee, he has two children who are in wheelchairs. So what we did is we worked with Courage Center and got one of their occupational therapists to work with us in custom designing this house. And so in the bedroom where the two children in wheelchairs are going to sleep, we installed a lift with this track system. So you can see how the track then goes down the hallway, and then it is a specially designed bathroom. And so the family is able to live in this house, and it's a family of eight. The two children who are in wheelchairs aren't pictured here, but this is the family. And so they make, so this family of eight makes below $50,000 a year. They now have a house where they all fit in, where they can thrive and go to school and pay an affordable mortgage for 30 years. And the likelihood of them being able to find a house that fits eight people, that has an affordable mortgage on it, that has this lift, it's not likely, quite frankly, in the metro area. So this house in the Phillips neighborhood appraised for $235,000. And we sell Habitat homes for their appraised value. And so that's what the mortgage amount is for. However, this home cost us $252,000 to build. And when I say we budget for that, we just know that we're going to eat that $17,000 because we have a commitment to try to figure out how to help families, like this beautiful family, have homes that meet their accessibility needs. So we right now have 253 low-income families who are pre-qualified for our mortgage. They've come in and they've qualified for the program. They show that they make the right amount of money. They don't make too much, but they don't make too little. They're able to pay their mortgage. And when Chair Clark had us in to meet about this bill, I went back and sort of went through our files, and I was trying to figure out how many families with children with disabilities could this impact. Right now, about 6% of our current buyers in this pool of 253 have children who are living with disabilities, some with behavioral disabilities and more with physical disabilities. Now, we'll sell 55 homes this year. So already, only a quarter of the families who are pre-approved for our mortgage will we have a home that they could match that mortgage to. So we will say no to more people than we say yes to. And only two of the 55 homes would be for accessibility. So now, if you agreed to pass House File 2116 and resources went to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I'd prefer to see them go to the Challenge Fund at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, what we would do is apply to the agency for that $17,000 difference between the appraised value that we sold it for and the actual development costs. And we would know then that that resource would come for the agency to help make up the difference and made it possible for this house to be accessible. The other way this fund could be used is that while we decide to be the custom home builder on two of our 55 houses, our typical model is to just, we build houses. We renovate foreclosed homes. Here's one, 585 Cook in East St. Paul, and one of our better volunteers, Congresswoman McCollum, is a hardcore volunteer. She does not come out for a photo op. She comes out and works hard when she is out there. So 585 Cook we built, and then we decided to sell it. And the family that we sold it to, this is it this last summer, it turned out to be a very cute house. 585 Cook, we matched it to a family with a child with severe autism with, you know, symptoms very similar to Jama's sons, to the children that were described in the earlier testimony. And the family has asked us for renovations to this home. The first thing they have said is that they absolutely have to have a fence because their son wants to run away. So they need a high security fence. They'd like the bathroom remodeled. They'd like ceiling joists put in. He needs a swing so that he can be in constant motion. And they can't have just a regular joist that would hold his weight. And they need plywood walls so he doesn't bang his head through the plaster the way he is wont to right now in his apartment. So that is about $12,000 to $15,000 of renovations. Now, we've already built this house, and we don't have the capacity to add that to our budget because we've already done our two ADA compliant homes. And so what we've agreed with the family is that we'll build the fence. Like I just dug around in a budget and found the money to build the fence. But you know what I had to say to the home buyer is, when I bought my home, I had an unfinished attic and I knew my mother-in-law was going to live with me, and so I had to save up and finish up that attic after we had moved in. And I had to explain to her that as a homeowner, she has to do the same thing. She has to save up and, you know, do the renovations for her son after she moves in. Now, if these resources were at the Housing Finance Agency in the Challenge Fund, what I would do is come to the agency and lay out for them that at 585 Cook for $15,000, we could make an affordable, accessible unit of housing. At, you know, in South Minneapolis, we could do the same. And that this house file would provide those resources. And with the languages, have you introduced the amendment? Okay. With the language as it's amended, where it is so that any nonprofit developer could have access to this, the pool of funds for the $600,000, that this would be available across the state to Habitat affiliates. So there are, we build 60 houses a year, and another 60 houses get built by the 30 affiliates who are in Greater Minnesota, and all of them would have this similar opportunity, because, you know, disability happens to families all across the state, and I think this would be a great resource for other nonprofit housing developers as well.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Beckman was referring to an amendment, and it should be in your folder. It is an amendment that I guess we should adopt so that we have that. We can adopt the amendment in the committee, and then
until we're running short on time.
So I know we are. Mr. Chairman, this is just to put it in the order that we
sure.
would...
Sure.
And then I'll be done. So if I could move that the DE2 amendment be added to House File 2116, I would appreciate if we could do that, and then we'll move on.
Representative Clark has moved that the amendment that she would like to add to put the bill in the shape that she would like. Without further ado, should we take a vote?
Please, Mr. Chairman. It just makes it more flexible than what we had before.
All right. Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is
thank you.
Passed.
So, members, you have the bill before you. I don't know if you have any particular questions for me. I'd be glad to try to answer. This bill will be back before us when we can actually vote on the funding that we hope to have in this committee. But if there are any other questions right now, I'd be glad to do it with the witnesses here. If not, Mr. Chairman, then I think...
There were some other questions as well. In the interest of trying to move along...
Okay.
We will have another opportunity to ask about this particular... So
we're not going to be...
Sorry, but we're going to have to move on.
Representative O'Neill, so I guess we do have two other bills, and it took us a little longer than we thought. But I thank the committee for hearing this bill. As you can tell, it's a really important bill and will help prevent homelessness and by helping provide some opportunities for some more home ownership for some very needy families. So at that point, Mr. Chairman, I'm going
to... Okay. So that...
Thank you.
Representative Clark renews her motion that this be laid over for later consideration. And please hang on to your questions until then. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could we just ask when it would be coming back?
We don't have a target yet, so we don't know exactly when that will be. Next week sometime, perhaps. I know.
Thank you, committee members, and thank you, witnesses. It's a little probably unsatisfying not to be able to have a vote today, but we would like you to come back. We will have a vote later. All right. Next House file before us is House File 2192, Representative Allen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
This is a bill we can vote on today, members.
Okay.
And we would be sending it to civil law. Can I have a motion? Mm-hmm. Representative Isaacson moves that House File 2192 be referred to civil law.
Thank you. House File 2192 allows renters who have a physician-certified medical condition, illness or disability that hinders their ability to remain in their current housing situation. It provides these individuals opportunity to end their lease with a two-month notice if they must move to an appropriate type of medically assisted housing unit, such as assisted living, a nursing home, hospice care, housing with services, or other accessible unit. And Paul Brinberg here will outline the specific housing establishments allowed. In this case, the tenants would, their rent would remain due during the two-month notice period. And this notice period mirrors the current notice that an estate must provide to a landlord when a tenant dies. For the most part, none of us can control the circumstances that might put us in a situation like this when our current home is inadequate to manage and care for our medical condition. A renter facing these circumstances is not trying to skip out of their obligations to the landlord. They are in dire need of medical care. In addition to offering relief to the tenant and their family during a difficult period of major life transition, this bill provides fair compensation to the landlord and adequate notice to allow for a timely turnover of the unit. Madam Chair, I'd like to have our two testifiers here share more about how this bill will benefit ill renters and their families during a difficult time in their lives.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman and members of the Housing Committee, my name is Penny Hested. I'm here today to share my experience with an unfortunate situation I had with my mom's apartment complex. My mom, at 86 years old, had a stroke in May of 2013. After about a week in the hospital, it was determined that she was not going to be able to live in her current independent living situation. It was a stressful time, of course. You're concerned about your mom, and there's a lot to get done in a short period of time to get her in an assisted living place. She was moved into a short-term rehab place, and during this time, I had to look for an assisted living home for her. I had to move her belongings. There was a lot of paperwork and nursing home assessments that I needed to have set up, take care of her finances. And one of the duties I had to do was try to negotiate the termination of her apartment lease. You know, as you can imagine, this is a real stressful time for a family, and unfortunately, when talking with the management company of where she was living, I was told that she was going to be responsible for the term of her lease. And this is when I contacted Homeline to see if we had any recourses, since she was unable to live on her own anymore and needed to be moved into assisted living. I found out from Homeline that there is no law to assist the elderly in this situation. This was a significant financial impact on my mom, and if this bill would have been in place at the time, we would have had at least one worry to take off of our plate. So on behalf of myself and my family, I thank you for your time and for considering this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Heasted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney at Homeline. I testified before this committee last year, so I won't go into great detail about Homeline, but very briefly, we're a tenant advocacy organization. We run a tenant hotline. We take about 12,000 calls a year. I probably do about a fifth of them, as one of the attorneys here. Present Minnesota law allows a tenant to break a lease unilaterally, that is without landlord permission, in only four situations. One is under Minnesota Statute 504B.131, the constructive eviction statute, which applies where the place is so wrecked that it's unlivable. Basically, there's a tornado or massive repairs the landlord hasn't gotten around to, and that's been the law for a century. The second law is a federal law, the Civil Service Members Relief Act, used to be the Soldiers and Sailors Act, allows a person in the armed forces who's been given orders to move away to give a 30-day notice. Now, of course, in that situation, I guess in a sense the person has a choice. He could go AWOL, but essentially he has no choice. The third situation is death. That is the death of each of the adult tenants, and the question is what happens to the estate. Current law allows the estate to give a two-month notice, very similar to what we're proposing here. And then lastly is the situation with domestic abuse victims under 504B.205 or 206 allows what amounts to a one-month notice. It's a little bit more complicated than that. This would add the missing piece where you've got a situation like Penny discussed where the tenant is faced with essentially a draconian choice of looking at paying out 10 more months of rent or staying in place and not getting the care they need. The stress on the family, as you heard here, this is very common. The family sometimes is legally on the hook for the rent, and morally they always feel that they're on the hook. We get calls like this on a regular basis on Homeline. It's not tons of calls because, thank God, most people don't have this kind of illness, but we certainly get some, and it'd be good to add this last piece of a person without control that has an illness that sends them to a nursing home or whatever. The bill is a very conservative bill. It requires first that there be all the tenants be in the situation, not just one of them. So if there's a couple, they both have to be having to move to this sort of situation. Secondly, there's a specific list. I won't read the bill. It'll bore you, but it's very specific places, nursing homes, accessible units, etc. And thirdly, and I think most important, it requires a certification from a physician that the person has this kind of illness and needs this kind of home. So it's not for somebody trying to fake an illness It's not even for serious illness. I'll give you an example from my own personal situation. My mother, now she lived in Washington, D.C., so this law wouldn't apply, but I mean, she had diabetes. That would not have qualified her. She was sick. She had to give insulin, et cetera. She then got pancreatic cancer and had a lot of problems, but was able to kind of make do at home. And then finally, near the end of her life, she got a stroke that essentially required 24-hour nursing home care. It's only at that third stage that this bill kicks in, assuming she would have gotten a letter from a doctor. In her case, that wouldn't have been a problem. So, again, it's a modest bill to deal with some very stressful situations of people who aren't it mirrors the two-month notice in the present 265, which deals with tenants who die. I thank you for your time, and you. I guess I'll stay around for questions after sure. The other people testify. Sure. Whatever you want to proceed.
Questions, comments? Representative O'Neill.
Seem to be the asker of questions today. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, who's the Senate author? Representative Allen? Who's the Senate author, please?
It is, there's one. Madam Chair, it's Senator John Marty.
Senator John Marty, okay. And then follow-up, please?
You go right ahead. I realized that I forgot to call one witness, but we'll take your question first, and then we'll call it witness.
Very good. Brenberg, Mr. Brenberg.
Yes.
You had said that you don't get a ton of calls. Do you have actually some data to say how prevalent this issue is? Is it one call a year or
no? It's
two calls a year.
I did a quick study. It was around 1.5 to 2% of our calls, but we get 12,000 calls a year, and we don't get calls from all the tenants. It's somewhere in the top 20 of our problems. It's a problem that comes up some, but not a lot. And I will say, the one thing I will add is that universally the landlord's position is we'll try. Some of them just say go jump in the lake. Most of them say we'll do everything we can to re-rent. But the landlords do not say, oh, we're going to let you off, and that's why this bill's needed.
Just a question.
Representative O'Neill.
So, Mr. Brenberg, if I understand your testimony here before us today, just so that we can understand the scope of this issue, are you saying that about 2,000 calls you get a year? Because you said 1 to 2% of your calls, you said you had 20,000 calls a year.
No, we get about 12,000 calls a year.
So about 1,200 calls would be accurate. Is that your testimony today?
24.
1%. Mm-hmm. We get about 150
right.
to...
Yes, so 150.
About 100 to 250... Roughly, somewhere in the nature of 100, 250 calls, depending on the year.
Okay,
there was one more witness then, members, if there's not a question right now. Representative Metzit, I want to make sure we get our last witness. I didn't mean to overlook you, Mr. Yes. Lindquist. I'm sorry. Why don't we let him, do you mind, Representative Metzit? Let's let him come first and make a comment, and then any questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, my name is Todd Lilgenquist. I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, and we are obviously very sympathetic to the concept of the bill. We believe that this happens, that this already happens in the vast majority of cases without regulation, wherein the property manager is approached by the resident who is confronted with this type of situation and works out an individualized case-by-case plan for the individual to move them on into a new facility. The scope of this bill is broad and similar to the domestic violence bill, which I believe will be before this committee, I believe, next week. And we've been negotiating with legal aid on that bill for, I believe, over a period of 6 months. So if this bill does continue to move forward, we'd appreciate being able to provide input.
All right. Thank you. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Allen. I just wanted to let you know I thought this was a no-brainer, real good idea. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a kind of a general question, I guess, in terms of the length of lease that a person signs. And if somebody is older, like we're all getting that way, can they sign a shorter lease up front, a six-month lease or a shorter lease, in anticipation of any kind of a possible medical situation?
Uh, re- Representative Anderson, and I noticed I have the same problem as I had last year, which is this is the driest room in the 12-county area, maybe the 87-county area, so I apologize. Representative, our experience is that landlords, they have standard leases based on their overall business plan. They tend not to vary from them. If their standard lease is a six-month lease, they offer a six-month lease. If it's a 10, if it's 12, it's 12. We get them 6, 12, 10, sometimes 18. And they landlords, they essentially don't negotiate over those. They just offer what they normally offer.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, something that's been rolling around, you say that you got about 100 to 250 calls and a year, and most of those are settled on site, basically. You said landlords will work with people?
No, I said just the opposite, which is that the landlord's position tends to be, we're not going to cut you any slack, but the one thing we will do is we will market your unit. But they leave the people open to, and in some cases having to pay the 10 months. No, they're not voluntarily giving the kind of relief that this bill would give.
Okay.
Representative,
I'm a little worried about unintended consequences, and the reason I say that is because if we're not looking ahead, and I know that if you sign a shorter lease, generally your rent will be higher. And if a landlord is looking at a lease renewal or a new lease, if they're going to start taking into account the age of the renter, would there be more people turned down? Would rents be higher? And is there any studies that or anything that you looked at in those areas that might come up behind and get you from the backside?
Representative Allen.
Madam Chair, I believe that under current law, they would be protected. They wouldn't be able to discriminate based on age or so. I think this is intended for. I mean, if you look at the types of circumstances, tornado, death, military duty. Well, military that might be somewhat foreseen, but most of this is unforeseen. So somebody may be in their apartment for years and their medical condition deteriorates, and they're deemed by a doctor no longer able to take care of themselves, and then they're going to be moving to a specific facility. So I think landlords, they will negotiate, but at the same time, they're going to market the unit, but they're going to still be liable for the have sort of like secondary liability, so that if it would be like almost like a sub, it would be a sublease. So if they're not relieved of the legal liability, they're gonna market the apartment. They're gonna sublease it, but the tenant's still gonna be liable if something should occur during the remainder of that lease.
And I should add, we'll be liable completely if the subleasing fails, which sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Okay. Are there any further discussion? If not, House File 2192 is before us to be referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. And it moves on to Civil
Thank
Law.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. We have one more bill, committee members. Representative Mullery. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll move your bill, Representative Mullery. Move it, and it would be also going to civil law, to be referred to civil law.
And, Madam Chair, would you move the A1 amendment?
Yeah, I move the A1 amendment. Representative Mullery, that gets it in the shape you want it to be in?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Okay, this is a courtesy motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and that amendment is before us, the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll explain the bill and then the amendment, why it's needed. Basically, members, I've been practicing law in this state over 30 years and handled thousands of contract disputes, and there was always a duty to mitigate that we built into it. It wasn't built in, it's built in by Minnesota common law. And I just found out actually this year that the one area of the law the duty to mitigate doesn't apply to is landlord-tenant law. And it really makes sense to me to add fairness to landlord-tenant law just like it is in other contract law. Right now, if a tenant has to move out and another good tenant wants to move in, I think the landlord should allow it, but they don't have to. And what really the bad thing that's happening, especially the worst thing, is that landlords are now telling the tenant that they won't allow a re-rent unless the vacating tenant pays a big fee, kind of extortion to the landlord. And that just doesn't seem fair to me to be doing that. And so I'll explain. The reason that we have the amendment is just to comply with state and federal law on subsidized housing, but I'd like to have Mr. Paul Bernberg explain the bill further and the facts behind it.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, and I remain Paul Bernberg, the same job I had 10 minutes ago when I testified in the other bill. Explain a couple things. One, let me expand a little bit about what it means, the duty to mitigate, which applies to all contracts except leases. Suppose I agree to sell Representative Clark 100 gallons of milk for $300 total wholesale with her to pick them up. She runs short on money, comes to me and says, I'm not going to pay, I'm not going to buy it. Sorry. What am I supposed to do? Under the common law, ultimately, if I can't make good on this, I get to sue her. But I am required to mitigate. That is, when I originally put up some signs in my building and put a notice on the milk seller's website, I got to do that again, at least try to market it. And if, for example, Representative Anderson, who's far more stable and trustworthy, comes to me with his $300 and says, I'll take that milk. You got to help me, you know, pick it up, etc. I can't say, well, no, I'm just going to go after Representative Clark because now I can mitigate. He's made it available so that I could break even on this thing. I make the deal with him. I still get to sue Representative Clark, who's untrustworthy, for the extra cost that it's come to me because I've had to go through this secondary procedure, but it's not going to be $300. It's going to be some lesser sum. Obviously, I'm using round numbers to make my point. But that's true with every contract in this state, with one exception, and that's leases. And that I'm not exaggerating. People say, oh, you're just trying to make it sound terrible. This law is pre-revolutionary, colonial-era law, because in the old days, leases were considered some kind of sale, where now leases are clearly a contract. I mean, they're about this thick, most of them. They have a lot of clauses in them. And this would drag Minnesota into sort of the modern era. I've passed out, I think every one of you on the committee should now have in front of you a map I generated showing the current state of the law. The pre-revolutionary law has been undone in almost all the states. 43 states plus the District of Columbia now require duty to mitigate, essentially what this bill does. One of them, South Dakota, has never faced the issue. They almost faced it a couple years ago, and the lease said mitigate, so they hinted they were going to require it anyhow, but they passed on it. So we're just trying to drag Minnesota, make us join the rest of black on that map, which is, for reasons having it, who knows why, New York, and then three, four southern states. So as Representative Mullery hinted at, when this comes up is a tenant who skip out on the lease. They don't have a super sympathetic situation where it's out of their control, like in the previous bill. They get a divorce, they lose a job, they get a better job, they get some kind of illness and they need a specialist doctor somewhere. Occasionally they break a lease for personal reasons like wanting to buy a house. Those are by far the most sort of situations we get. The problem arises is many landlords will try to mitigate, but they're the bad ones, there are a few that just intentionally sit on their hands and basically tell the Representative Clarks of the world to go jump in the lake. There are a few that do that, but they wait for Representative Clark to bring them a good applicant for a subleaser, and then they tell her no, heck with it. And then the more common thing is sort of a scam, which is they will sell to the tenant for a few hundred dollars, often a month or two of rent. A month is pretty typical. They'll sell to the tenant mitigation. That is, they're not selling to the tenant to get out of the lease, which makes a lot of sense, essentially the tenant buying himself out of the situation. For a few hundred dollars, they'll say, we'll try. Now, they were probably going to try over anyhow in most situations. And then occasionally, when I got another, I generally just throw these forms out because it happens so often. I deal with them one or two of these a week. But you also get the situation where the tenant actually goes to the trouble of finding a quality subletter, brings it to the landlord, and the landlord says, okay, I'll take that person, not for the $35 or $50 it's going to take me to run his credit and make sure he's an okay, suitable tenant, but the case I had this morning, which was like for $450, they would take the tenant that the incumbent tenant brought him. So we're trying to put an end to that. I want to emphasize that mitigate does not mean take any tenant. The case law in the other states, we of course don't have it because we don't have this rule because of historical reasons. Mitigate means take a suitable tenant, not any tenant, a suitable tenant. Tenant meets your normal criteria. As Mr. Representative Mullery indicated, as revised, the bill makes an exception for certain subsidized programs and that language probably even needs a little more improvement, and by the next committee, I think we can get that improved. It only covers residential leases. Commercial leases have somewhat different situations since, you know, if you want a clothing store, you may want an exact kind of clothing store. So commercial leases are not in this bill. Maybe it should be, but it's not. It's a bilateral bill, incidentally. It places the duty on the tenant to mitigate damages as well. Probably most of those cases he already has to because this lease sublease thing, as I say, from pre-revolutionary times. But to conclude, this bill is not about breaking a lease. It's just about asking the landlord to do what he would normally do when the tenant leaves. No more and no less. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we do have one more witness. Again, Mr. Lillenquist. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Todd Lillenquist. I'm with Minnesota Multi Housing Association. Would we just have a couple minutes?
We do.
Okay.
We're running short, so if you can be brief, that would be great.
Duty to mitigate in real estate law and landlord-tenant law is not just about the contract. It's not just contract law. So when we compare it to all other areas of contract law, real estate is a granting of a bundle of rights. It's a conveyance of an interest in that real estate. Certainly there are contractual elements, but it is not simply just a contract the same way that you would contract with a manufacturer to manufacture a certain number of widgets. It is different. And traditionally, mitigation of damages has not been an obligation in real property law. I'll let the other testifier talk to the assignment and sublease concerns that we have with the bill. But in short, I'll be very brief, try and be very brief. We believe that it undermines the value of the lease. The simplest way to get out of your lease when there is a duty to mitigate is to simply no longer pay rent. And then in the obligation, the burden is shifted to the other party to find an appropriate applicant and an appropriate and suitable way to mitigate those damages.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm a resident of Minneapolis, and I'm the owner of Cornerstone Property Professionals. And I'm a licensed real estate broker. We're a small company that owns and manages our own small portfolio, primarily in South Minneapolis. I've been involved in the property management business for more than 15 years, and I've served on the board of directors of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I would like to respectfully point out some serious concerns with the proposed legislation. We actively manage our properties, This is especially important because I have a large number of units in proximity to areas of our city challenged with livability crimes. I know this because I serve as the Neighborhood Crime and Safety Chair. The assignment of leases and subleasing is not our business practice. It's not our business practice because I must carefully screen our tenants. The regulatory practices in the city of Minneapolis place a heavy burden on landlords to ensure that we are crime-free facilities. Many municipalities are active in this area of enforcement. The penalties are significant if we do not act diligently and with all vigilance. Therefore, when we have the rare occasion that a tenant abandons their unit or has been evicted, we try very hard to avoid a recurrence. It's expensive because of the lost revenues. And as a matter of good business, we want that unit reoccupied quickly. In other words, we mitigate the damages as a matter of course because we're losing potential revenue. And we have almost no chance of recovering that loss from the departing tenant. But if a tenant wanted to abandon the lease or was being evicted, they could use this provision as written if it was law. Then we would be forced to assign the lease or sublease. My expectation is that we would end up with friends, relatives, and associates of the tenant being the assignee or sublessee, which given the previous activity in the unit may or may not be much of an improvement. I can easily imagine a scenario where I'm evicting a tenant because of narcotics activity in the unit, and the tenant assigns the lease to an associate who may continue the prior activity which originated the original eviction. I can tell you my local police narcotics unit and the city regulatory services would raise eyebrows at the new tenant and hand me a warning notice. And a second offense at the property in 12 months, I can then have my rental license revoked. This provision, in conjunction with the local ordinances, potentially sets me up to lose my rental license and put my good tenants on the street. I know that the author's intent is to help tenants, but this may be to the detriment of my good tenants. I urge you to carefully consider the unintended consequences of the bill so we do not harm the livability of our properties and interfere with good management practices. Thank you for your consideration.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all...
Can you speak into the microphone a little
bit? I'm sorry. Yeah. I do want to correct something that Todd said. He said the lease is a conveyance of interest in real estate. That's only if it's over a three-year lease, and very rarely is a residential tenant lease over 3 years. Also, that it would... this whole statement about forcing them to lease to narcotics and things like that, as Mr. Bernberg said, it's a reasonable... I would not be carrying this bill, and the chair and my districts have the most problems in the state of Minnesota with that issue, and so to even suggest that I would be carrying a bill that would do that is just bizarre. The fact is that reasonable is built in. They only have to try to mitigate to a reasonable tenant to go in there, and that's just plain fact.
Okay. Any other comments or questions from committee members? I do want to point out that some of the legal discussions that we're having right here at that table will be happening in civil law, and so we have this is referred to our committee because it is a housing issue, but the details of that kind of legal discussion will be happening in the next committee, so just for your information. Any further discussion? Okay, if not, I renew my motion that House File 2151 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails. And the bill is re-referred. Thank you very much. Committee members, thank you for staying a few extra minutes.
Madam.
Appreciate it. Representative Hertas?
Did you want to take care of your minutes?
Yes, thank you so much. Would you like to move the minutes of...
I would move that the minutes are approved from the...
We have a motion on the floor.
I have the other dates here. The two meetings prior to last week, February 26th, and I would note that on the February 26th meeting minutes, you do not designate the date.
We will correct that. Thank you. With that correction, Any further discussion on the 2 minutes? If not, oh, excuse me, there's three dates and minutes. Three. Everything before session is what we're dealing with. Thank you, Representative Hertas. Any further discussion? With that correction, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, members. We hope to have a target pretty soon, and as soon as we do, we will start being able to act on the bills that have money in them. Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, do we have a hearing on Wednesday?
Pardon me?
Do we? Okay.
What was the question?
Hearing on Wednesday?
Do we have a hearing on Wednesday?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Has that notice?
I believe it was on the schedule, and it should be. It should have gone out already. Why don't you sit down and say this?
Okay, very good.
I'll say it on the record.
It's just out of
finance.
It's
maybe double check.
Okay, then we've got a website problem. I know it's on my computer.
We will double check and make sure that y'all got the notice.
Just for the record. Well, I do know that we had our database did shut down last week Friday. So let me make sure that that's not a reason that you guys can't see it. So let me look at that.
All right. We'll take care of it. The meeting is adjourned.